Hey Christian, how's it going?
Daniel, nice to connect. Thank
Nice
you.
to
Going
connect as
well.
well. How are things going in the world of Christian Friedland? Or do you prefer Chris? How do you usually go?
I prefer whatever you want to call me. I like it both ways. I'm very, very easy. But I'm having a lovely morning, enjoying my third cup of coffee here in beautiful Dorado, Puerto Rico.
That's nice. Yeah, I know you're based in Puerto Rico. Andrew Gazdecki, who was very, very helpful and had such a great set of knowledge to share on this podcast, he told me you're based in Puerto Rico, and we talked a bit about you. Not gossip, I can assure you. He had only great things to say about you, which is why I reached out and wanted to invite you for a chat. Thank you so much for coming. I'll dive straight into it. You seem to me like a straight shooter. You don't seem to beat the bush, right? And I just love that. So I've listened to your episode with Andrew, and sometimes I just get hit by people indirectly, such as yourself. I feel like I was listening to you and an invisible hand slapped me because of the honesty and the straightforwardness you had. And I just love it when people have that. Are you like that with everyone? Can you only be like that with some people? Talk to us more about that.
That's a good observation. Again, Andrew, absolutely one of my favorite people. One of my, I'm not gonna say at a point was one of my best investments. I've had some really great ones since, but I definitely enjoyed the journey. And I think a lot of the reason why Andrew and I connected so much is, yeah, I've been known to be told that I have no filter, which sometimes has hurt me. But however, that's kind of been my MO since I was a child. I'm not a young child. I probably as I got into my teens, I realized that the easiest thing to do is just, say what comes off the top of my mind rather than position and game and politic and subtly promote. Whenever I find myself in a position where I'm becoming that person that's promoting, or I feel disingenuous. I feel like the more authentic and genuine I can be, the better. So it just comes out naturally for me like that.
That makes sense. And I think every piece of advice could be a time shortcut. I'm trying to ask you for advice so I can get myself a time shortcut, if you'd be so kind. I like that. When I see it in people, I try to emulate it because I see the effectiveness, the efficiency of it. Did you have to balance yourself with time? Did it ever bite your ass in a way? Or were you just always like this and you were my way or the highway, alienated some people and that was it?
I'm definitely not a my way or the highway kind of guy at all. So don't mistake. Like, I know a lot of people that are in the same vein of having no filter, but are also fucking cocksuckers. Like, they've got that they're rude and direct and have no filter, but they're fucking assholes. I try. What did one of my One of the CEO of Ferguson, one of the people I saw my company to, what he used to say, because I'd be direct and I'd prod at people, make jokes, and they'd say, we tease because we love. Like you can be direct and not be an intentional asshole. You may come off as an asshole because you're direct. A lot of people may take that as offensive. But you can be both. It was funny, I was in the UK for a while doing some work and hanging out with the Brits. And they were really funny on the ones that I spent time with, at least their view on Americans as being like, did not take direct talk well. Like especially in like the corporate environment, people will position and speak and no one just wants to. So they thought that I was a very unique American in the fact that I would just say whatever came off the top of my mind. This seems like all bullshit. And what do you mean this is all bullshit? And then reserve the right to change my mind. There's a purity of being direct, and there's also a purity in a willingness to be wrong and change your position that I think, to your point, comes back to just being very, very efficient with time and knocking out a lot of the chit-chat bullshit. I don't do podcasts normally, but the fact that you interviewed Andrew and requested, I figured if Andrew's involved, I'm into burn an hour with you. I mean, as if Joe Rogan or Joe Rogan gives you a call, which I don't think we have a lot to talk about.
I appreciate that. So hold on a second. The Brits were saying that the Americans are not used to direct talk, or was it the other way around? Just to make sure.
Well, you know, the Brits tend to be very dry and direct and come off as sometimes rude, you know, to America, and to, or at least in business conversations was their position. And what was funny was, is they said you don't beat around the bush. You come off as very, very direct. I know sometimes people, the British are very proper, but in at least my business experience in the UK has usually been very, very direct. And America, we tend to, I guess, be, I wouldn't say disingenuous, but almost, what do they call us? Fake nice, like pretend nice, you know, why always smiling, always in a great mood, but, you know, always very, you know, fake nice and fake authentic, I think, to some degree. I think there's a shade of, I love America and I'm very proud to be American Puerto Rican now. but there's a shade of that, I think, in American culture and the nature of being American.
That makes sense. The reason why I'm asking is because I feel like when you're exploring, you said you picked up on this ever since you were a teenager. So you were on the other side of the spectrum. You said every time you didn't act like that, you felt disingenuous. So I feel like when you're, especially as you're growing up, such as in the position that, I mean, I guess we're all growing, but whatever, you're on an interval. And unless you explore both ends of the interval, you can't calibrate yourself. And that's exactly what I was trying to get to with you, which you very well pointed out, this calibration of where do I stand? Because you said, even though it might look like this, don't mistake it with being an asshole or a cocksucker. at the same time, you can also be polite. And I see that in you. I'm still in the process of calibrating myself and maybe even the listeners. I've got to make a change with this podcast. Who knows? While they're listening. How do you, because there's a fine line. The reason why I mentioned an interval is there's a fine line where you calibrate yourself. Any pointers you have when it comes to that? So you want to be respectful. You started with that. What else is there? I feel like it's very easy to have no filter. But as you said, it's also a bit of a dance.
No, actually, I think that's interesting that you said that, because I really, looking back on my childhood and now that I'm well into adulthood and middle age, what my friends wouldn't believe is that I used to actually be a very quiet and meek child. Like I was very polite, very sweet boy. And, you know, I think, you know, through schoolyard bullying, and I thank all of my bullies for kind of teaching me the perils of being meek and mild. You know, sometimes you have to try on a different coat, right? And then I started being more direct and more brash and more. And I probably had been to the extreme too much in that regards, in how I had crushed people, you know, some of my personal relationships by just steamrolling them. Mm-hmm. And I think that the trick is finding there's two ways. One, finding that balance within yourself so you don't steamroll over people and miss important cues in conversations and miss important facts. And then there's also how you behave towards others. There's a difference between offering somebody I won't call it the unvarnished truth, because the truth is also often a matter of someone's opinion, but your unvarnished opinion in being direct. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's like, so taking that to a business perspective, I'm in the process of working with or selling this business that I have, and, you know, talking to potential buyers. They'll go, the ones that aren't interested will say, oh, it's missing this or it's missing that. Or if you're going to raise money, VCs will say, oh, you know, the timing's a little off for us. We wish you the best. Mm-hmm. And then they'll go back and say, you know, founder's an idiot, market's shit. And then the unvarnished comes out. But what service did you do that company by saying, oh, pat on the back? Sometimes the direct talk it was super helpful. And I'm drawn to people that have no, you know, not attacking me personally. And I think that's where you really delineate the line. Is your direct talk creating, unnecessary damage? Are you just being a bully? Or are you being direct and you're actually helping somebody? Because sometimes the it's, what's the old song? It's cruel to be kind. Sometimes just that directness is, has really been some of the biggest resets in my life, in my personal life, in my business life, where people just punch you right in the face and go, no fucking way, man. Yeah. And then again, sometimes they're wrong. Again, that's the, it's exposing your truth. You know, a lot of people for a lot of my businesses told me this is never going to work. This is why. And I would be thankful. I'm like, thank you for telling me this. I think you're fucking wrong. But rather than sugarcoating and being polite, it's just right between the fucking eyes without attacking me or attacking the person that you're providing that unvarnished and direct advice to. Because otherwise, and then the deeper a personal relationship, the more, even the more direct you can be, but so I try to skip a lot of those formalities in direct conversations, interpersonal as well as in business.
That's super helpful because, as I said, it helps myself and maybe other people draw the line, calibrate ourselves. So it's about the place where it comes from. Am I getting this right?
I think not even the place where it comes from. Yeah, I agreed. And I think it, at my worst in interpersonal relationships, I can be a bully or I can steamroll people. I have a really good friend of mine who's this like this bulletproof MMA fighter that, you know, could, you know, kill me in probably 8 seconds if we ever got into a physical altercation. And, you know, I was in a point in my life at one point where I was really off course, just interpersonal, like my personal life, even last couple of years ago, it was a mess. And like went through this whole process and like really got my bearings. And this guy, my buddy, one of my best friends, is like, dude, I didn't know how to approach you, man. You're fucking terrifying. And I'm like, I'm terrifying. He's like, yeah, you're fucking terrifying. And I think, you know, when, again, at your worst, you can be a steamrolling fucking bully. Mm-hmm. And even people, you know, you can, it's not even about like, yeah, and then this is the guy that I would consider like, you know, like Navy SEAL fucking killing in 30 seconds. But like, I think the dark side of being overly direct and overly, you can just steamroll people. And so you, I think you really nailed it. There's like a real balance between that and just be closing your mouth and being meek and not saying anything and not speaking your truth. So yeah, I probably err more on the side of being overly so. And then there's the side of the people I know that they don't get a lot about what they want out of life because they're too meek or because they're too quiet. And I'm sure you've seen that archetype of person and personality before.
That's great. I appreciate, by the way, the honesty and vulnerability in sharing. This is the second time you're doing it already a few minutes into the conversation. So, and that builds trust. That's exactly what I've got after your podcast with Andrew. I said, I already trust this person because, as you said, if they don't like whatever, they'll just say it if I ask for their opinion, and et cetera, et cetera. Another thing I can't figure out about you is that, so you're definitely outspoken. You, I don't know if you're an extrovert, but you are able to be an educated extrovert, at least because that's an interval as well. I love the way you talk. You're able to talk. You don't care that much about exposing yourself. And when I say exposed, that's Latin for, I guess, becoming more popular, building a personal brand, blah, blah, blah. In a world where this draws the attention of my generation, I'm 24, so I'm part of the social media generation, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You look
what was it? MySpace, Friendster. I was on social media before you were even born, son. But no, I understand the importance of back then it was play, and now people's social media personas defines them. And so I'm sorry to interrupt, but keep going because you were on an interesting thread there.
No worries, I'll get back to you. But I was talking as well to a friend of mine who is 48. And I was explaining to him the dynamics of what I meant by social media generation, like smartphone generation. I explained to him that, look, if a girl follows you on Instagram, that's like, imagine like the equivalent of medieval ages when they were dancing in circles and a guy is inviting a girl to a dance and she says yes. It's not conclusive, but it's a step forward. He was like, what the fuck is that's just a follow. I said, yes, but she's following you back. So anyways, I explained to him that kind of dynamics, which made me think of this. What I was getting at is in the generation that I grew up in, where it looks like it's important and all that stuff, personal brand, you're quite low key. How come? What gives? Is it just because you don't have a main business that would benefit from you building a personal brand, such as Andrew? Andrew is a great example. Microacquire, it would help him a ton to attract entrepreneurs, and guess what? He does it and it grows the business. So what gives?
That's a great question. And yeah, and just a tip of that to Andrew. Andrew is a PR. I mean, the guy is a PR machine, man. Working with him and relentless. I remember he would get his business featured in TechCrunch every 30 days, just by relentlessly hammering editors and asking why. He was absolutely he still is probably personally one of the best just guerrilla marketing PR guys that I know. And that's interesting. And just to be clear, I'm a software developer by trade. So I've been involved in since Commodore 64, Amiga, IBM 8088, if you even know what that is. I was programming in BASIC when I was 9. So I've always made a point personally just not to stay. I try to stay as close to the edge of what's going on and at least have a functioning knowledge, jack of all trades, master of none. And social media is something that I felt, that I've needed to participate in. Not only because I do enjoy the social engagement, but I did see, so I'll tell you a funny story. So back at Build.com, and one of my worst investment mistakes ever, there was a guy named Shane Sweeney, and he was one of those software developers who, when I talk about software developers, there's like. The when you find one of those 10x developers, it's like a 10x CEO or a 10x marketing person, they can do the work of 10 people just independently on their own. And they see so clearly, they don't need a lot of requirements. You can almost throw a raw idea at them and they'll just build it to perfection. Shane, I've probably known about 10 or 12 of those people in my life, and Shane Sweeney was one of them. He grew up in Chico. And he worked at Build.com for a while, my former company, and he decided he wanted to move to the Bay Area and like really pursue a degree, work with tech startups. We were working on a startup together that ended up not working out. And in the midst of it, he was my only engineer, less than three guys. And he calls me and he's working out of these labs and he says, hey, I hate to tell you this, but I'm leaving. I'm gonna go work for this tech startup. It's called Bourbon. And I said,
I know what it
what is
is.
it? He said, oh, it's a social media, it's like a photo sharing app. And I said, he said, can you talk to the CEO? Give me a referral. And I'm like, dude, I hate to lose you. And he's like, dude, if nothing else, he's like, hey, you should call these guys. They're raising a Series A, like just put in 100 grand or something. And I'm like, photo sharing app? And then so I research it and this Bourbon, it's backed by Andreessen Horowitz. Andreessen Horowitz abandoned them. And invested in this other app called PicPlease, which was going to really be the leader in this photo sharing. And I'm like, this thing's either one of two things. It's going to be a freaking rock star success or go to zero. But I tend to be a pretty boring cash flow. I like companies with revenue, et cetera. So I had this call with Kevin Systrom. I talked for, they didn't even own Instagram at the time. It was gr.am. And he's like, is there anything? He said, I said, Shane's going to be your best. Shane was the third hire. I said, this guy's an absolute 10x developer. And he's like, anything do you need anything from me? And there was my opportunity to say, hey man, just let me edge into your Series A. But I'm like, why would I invest in a photo sharing app? And your lead investor abandoned you. I was like, Shane, best of luck. 18 months later, would have been the best investment of my life. So I, my Instagram profile is not prolific, but one of the first because I was like, well, let me join and see what this rebranded Bourbon thing is. So I've followed this arc of social media and how important it's became in people's lives. I mean, I missed the boat in a major way, and Shane obviously did very well, and I'm very proud of him for the success that he had. But it has been for me fascinating to watch like this entire the. I mean, it's been such a world-changing paradigm, especially Instagram, because that was kind of the real. I mean, Facebook kind of got things started, but Instagram really created this entire societal shift around people's entire value of who they are. I mean, especially chick. I mean, not, I don't want to say just women. People have like put their entire life in this. Like, if you get platform banned on Instagram, like it's a suicide event for some people. Like their entire not just either financial and net worth are tied up in this thing. And for me, I enjoy social media. I'm old, so I still use Facebook quite a bit. I'm semi-active on Instagram, but I never ever saw the want from a personal perspective. Can I have people come all the time? We need to build your brand. We need to build your brand. And you have this Gary, whatever, or you're like this guy. And I didn't want any of that. I didn't want any of that. I always wanted to be the guy who, you know, I can show up at a party. Mm-hmm. And no one knows who the hell I am. And that's absolutely fine by me. I just never had the desire. And going back to your point on Andrew, I think if I had a business reason to build a persona, I would do it in a very narrow vertical. And I wouldn't want the attention associated with people walking into a party and going, oh, that's Chris Friedland, you know, the guy that did this and this. It just doesn't appeal to me. I don't have any desire for it. I appreciate my anonymity.
That's interesting. And I understand how you mentioned that specific vertical, but it's for a specific purpose. And yes, I guess some people have a specific purpose for their own soul or whatever part of body that is, that you don't have. Yeah, and props to Andrew as well. See, speaking about Andrew, when you were describing him as a PR machine, before we recorded the podcast, him and I, he said, oh, wait, I've got this tweet right here, because he just said something to me. He tweeted that. And that has gotten some attention. And I always go on his tweets. You know, under a tweet, you can see where it was posted from. It says from Twitter for Android, Twitter for iOS. Or if you're using a scheduling tool, it says there. And I'm always like trying to catch him, see if he scheduled anything. All of them so far are natural, so he posts them when they come to his mind. He thinks in tweets, I guess. But interesting point. We've mentioned earlier being a straight shooter and what have you. I want to talk a bit about Felix Dennis and his book, How to Get Rich. I know it's one of your favorite books, that one, and Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad Poor Dad. And I can see why you liked it, because as I was reading the book, I had about the same invisible hand slapping me with a reality check from him, the same way I had it from you on the podcast. It was a breath of fresh air to see how straightforward, and he is also witty, but also cracking a joke, but also teaching you something. Shame he sadly died in 2014. I want to ask you about the book, How to Get Rich, which I highly encourage anyone listening to this to read. Any criticism or caveat or something you would change in his advice through the filter of your experience?
Well, I mean, you know, every generation has its own interesting times. And right now we live in, as a world, and people get so caught up watching CNN or Fox News and the degradation of, it's literally just dopamine hits for people at this point. And the information has been absolutely so manipulated. But I live in the vein, if you look at the numbers, if you look at the raw data, we live at a time in the world where we live in massive abundance. Mm-hmm. Ray Kurzweil is another really good read. Yep. And a great guy. I had dinner with him and you know, one of my heroes. Little weird, but sorry, y'all. We live in this world right now of such abundance, and every generation is a little bit different. So, you know, Felix Dennis was, you know, a poor kid trying to make his way and figure out like how to build an wealth and empire and enjoy all that. I think we live in an interesting time today though, where people's like, especially if you're in the US or a developed country, and even moving that direction, even in non-developed countries, except for some of the worst, you know, there's parts of Africa which are really miserable. And I've been to some of them, parts of LATAM that are still very, you know, third world, Asia, pick anywhere. You know, so I think it's, you know, that level of grit that he kind of was like, I'm going to find my way. By any means necessary. There's, I think we're in a soft, the generation's a little bit softer now because everybody's basic needs, a lot of people's basic needs now are more met than they were before. So You know, I love the story. I think I think that it's a little hard. It's a hard edge book that a lot of people may read and go, this is just, they won't relate to it because their lives are so much softer and easier than before. But I think the message that people don't want to miss, some of the quotes, and I'm going to paraphrase because I forgot, but basically there's a quote about riches are usually dug in ditches. And in a sense being, you know, a lot of people chase what's shiny, what's modern, what's new, and kind of don't focus on what, you know, fundamental, awesome, easy to solve problems that aren't necessarily as glamorous are going to show up as well on your Instagram profile than where there's real opportunity to do something meaningful, create change, build that first cushion of wealth so you have the discretion to be able to do whatever you want. And that's the real message that I got out of that book that I like people to get out of that book is you don't need to do something glamorous. You don't, you know, and I think the problem we have is you went back to on this whole society, a lot of society now judging itself based off the amount of followers that it has on Instagram or TikTok or Snapchat. We've started to lose sight. The other lose sight thing, I think, and going back to this entire point is around, there's all these mission, vision, I'm going to change the world entrepreneurs out there that everybody admires. So people, you know, the Google guys have kind of went dark and now handed everything over to the new CEO of Alphabet. But let's just take, you know, the most prolific, brilliant entrepreneur of our time, Elon Musk, as an example. Who can go through a podcast without mentioning that guy? He go back and look at his old videos back when, you know, he was fascinated with fancy cars and how rich he was and he can be this PayPal billionaire and it was all about money and whatever. And I think, you know, as we've lived through our lives and kind of hit that arc, eventually money becomes less important and it becomes like, you know, if you're the richest man in the world, or even you have over $100 million or $500 million, nothing else matters. Like all everything, you know, I do in college, I'll do this like math equation. Like, okay, if you had $50 million, you know, how much money do you need? And people will say, I used to speak on campus and they, you know, you want to build a company. What's your target? Well, I need $400 million. Well, why 400? And then we do the math and figure out, like, just based off of like conservative investment profile, that's like whatever that is, like $7 million a month that you're earning. So what are you going to do with that $7 million? Well, I'm going to buy a plane. Well, you could buy a couple planes. You can have a plane follow your plane. Then what are you going to do? People don't think through that. And they look to these people like Musk and everybody that are very late in their cycle and try to mimic them. And I think bringing that back down to it, you take a look at the Google guys, they try to sell to Excite. Go, you can Google it for like $9 million because they were just focused on, I want to build this company. I want to get rich. That's kind of where everybody starts. And then they reach this arc. But the problem is because these guys who've already made it and been through that whole trough are who you're kind of trying to mimic yourself at, you're never going to get there. I think is what it comes down to. You're never going to get to that level where you may be able to make a real big change and impact. So kind of a ramble, but again, that's what I get for four cups of coffee.
You've talked about this before, and to sum it up with your own very words, which I think is a great conclusion to what you just said and expand upon, you said in a different podcast, I can't remember which one, that at one point you transcend money in your journey as an entrepreneur, or at least that's what happened with these guys. So bottom line, what would you say? Is it PR bullshit, this change the world thing, or is it just that there are different level of the stair step, and that's what they have on their mind right now?
It is definitely, this is the biggest disconnect that people don't get. Once you hit that threshold, and I know I have personal friends with a handful of billionaires, and once you hit that threat, unless you have a mental disorder, at that point, the money doesn't matter. The money just doesn't fucking matter. I mean, and I'll tell you what, I have no remote desire to be a billionaire. No remote desire. everybody I know that's a billionaire, they've got security. They've got security for their kids. They've completely absolved themselves of any privacy. And their lives are no better than somebody who has $100 million. Yeah. Because what are you going to do with the money? Rent a yacht for 6 months in the Med, and then take your private jets around and throw massive parties with Instagram models. It's not going to cost you, cost you a couple million dollars, but you'll make that back up in interest when you eventually transcend money. Mm-hmm. And I think the message that people lose is, going back to the Felix Dennis thing, is when you're starting out and you're trying to build something, and money is always going to be on your mind, and it should be. And you may have a higher ESG type goal in the future of where you want to go. And maybe Musk, as an example, had this much, much earlier on, pre-PayPal, all of his many other successes. But Gates, the same way. Gates was just a money-hungry programmer. Look at Zuckerberg. He just wanted to build a site to spy on people and get laid. I mean, this is how these things germinate and start.
Yeah.
And people end up with this. They try to model themselves after this future state entrepreneur. When you really need to go take a, if you really want to study these guys, study them in their youth and follow that arc if you want to get there. Don't follow Elon and I mean, but I will temper that by saying, I mean, even Elon says some stuff, and I like him, and he's hard not to like, because he's such a direct speaker, like the shit out of his mouth. It's just, we live in the generation of the internet troll, which I actually identify with quite a bit, and it's became kind of standard. But like, I think it's important for people to understand where they're at in their journey, where their role models were at in their journey early on, and just don't focus on here, focus on here.
You're 100% right. And I can refer people kind of like a bibliography or reference, whatever they call it. Go look at Elon Musk after his sale of Zip2. It was his first company. The famous video with the McLaren coming out. And he just says in the interview, and he admitted it's in an arrogant way, something like cash is king, or Benjamins are Benjamins, something like that. And that's as he started PayPal, a bit before, or he already started, but it wasn't incubated yet. The reason why Felix Dennis is a breath of fresh air, or was, when I read the book, was like, just like you just said, it doesn't have to be about changing the world and all that story. Felix Dennis strikes me as a cool uncle who is sharing with you his evil, not evil, because he says in some talks, he says, sometimes I wake up and I think, whose arm and leg can I rip off and chew the meat off of their bone, referring to stealing their business or whatever in terms of money. So a cool uncle who somehow shares his evil, his anima, to use a psychological or philosophical term, but at the same time, at least some people love him. He's lovable in his cold shower, that it is ice cold bucket challenge that he pours upon you. Same for you, even though he didn't share any evil stuff. So
go ahead.
go on. Oh, I was done.
No, I mean, that's why I think I'm a believer in markets. I'm a huge believer in markets, in the sense that, socialism, generally speaking, in its extremes, don't work. I am not a dyed-in-the-wool hardcore libertarian. I don't even identify in a political party. I'm a pragmatist, I think, is my political party. I might have called myself a libertarian, but they're fucking weirdos too. but I think when it comes to for one thing, like I try never get into the politics of personal destruction, destroying people. Right. Mm-hmm. Like I try not to, we all have our angels and inner angels and devils, but I never try to get into, unless somebody really harms me or destroys me or tries to personally destroy me, I never try to get into the politics of personal destruction. But there's a certain, the fun thing about business and competition is, when you're playing, against another party and you're competing, think of it like sports team. you know, I'm not a sports guy and I don't watch many sports ball games, but like, you know, we're going to crush these, and then at the end of the day, ideally, if they're not all fucked up, everybody goes back and they all can party and talk about the game later and how someone did something else and like that. And I think you can do that in business, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you see, you know, people out competing and crushing their competitor by outmaneuvering, thinking through, doing a better job. I mean, an example, I'm still friends with Niraj Shah of Wayfair, who obviously is the much more successful version of what I did. But we were competing directly at each other, and we'd still do dinner once a quarter and sit down and just talk shit. And we kind of share a little bit, not share a little bit. And that's part of the fun of like, yeah. And then I would sneak attack and fuck him up in some other way. And then he'd pull something. I'd be like, oh fuck. He took and did what I told him I was going to do. And he did it faster. That motherfucker. So at the end of the day, like that, that's not being an enemy. That's being like a competitor. And yeah, we'd rip each other's arms off, but at the end of the day, what's really happening? Yeah, there's always going to be winners and losers in business. And there's still a esprit de corps you can have with competitors and so forth. That's why I like businesses and I like competitors that aren't rotten people. Like some, mm-hmm. and then sometimes you'll be working with somebody who's like, you know, putting spy equipment in your freaking conference room and like trying to, you know, personally attack you. And yeah, and those people, that then you declare war. And then I don't like those fights. That's not my idea of ripping somebody's arm off. That's my idea of like literally blood sport. So I think you can have that mentality and that competition and still maintain some esprit de corps with your competitors of whatever you're doing. And at the end, everybody wins. If you're in the right industry and you're all executing well, even though you didn't win, it's not like, you know, you got wiped out at the end of the day, or that's kind of like the worst outcome, I think.
Yeah.
You know, there was a period of time where Apple almost went out of business and Microsoft saved them. True. Right. And now you take a look at how the tables have, then they turned back for a while. And now Apple's on this ascent and that's business. And that's part of the fun. That's part of the fun of the fight. Right. And that's okay. It's just when it becomes nefarious and dark and personal and is where it's no fun. And I think the Felix Dennis piece that you're talking about is, you know, ripping some of these people's arm off is often, you know, Richard Branson, and Branson's another, he's a little old for you, but Entrepreneur's Entrepreneur. He has this little book, Screw It, Let's Do It, which is like a 20-minute read. It's a lot of fun. And he talks about like his war with British Airways. And it's just, it's funny and it's hilarious. And he absolutely wanted to kill them and they absolutely wanted to kill him. But it was never, you know, it was never like, you know, putting a hit out on his kid or something.
So an honorable competition with honor. Yeah. I want to get back to this in a second. I just want to ask you, do you have a hard stop with this just so I know how to dose the time?
No, you can keep going. I'm going to push my 11 with my buddy back just a hair. So yeah, well, let's just keep going. Absolutely.
Is 11 in 8 minutes? Cause I don't know your time zone.
Yeah. I'm in AST. So don't worry about it. Let's just keep going.
All right. Very interesting that you mentioned this competing with honor, because once again, you've been on this planet for longer than I am, which is Latin for you're more mature than I am.
older, yeah. Middle age now, unfortunately.
That's old Latin. I can only speak Latin, not old Latin. I want to talk about shamelessness, because it's again shamelessness in business, but the good kind of shamelessness, because it's again treading on this fine line. Felix Dennis again. At one point, first thing that made him a bit rich was the Bruce Lee move. He made a biography and milked that as a media asset, especially after Bruce Lee died. Then something he did was, and I don't know too much because it's not fully documented nor in his book, this is outside, he took Star Wars and the Star Wars franchise and made posters and what have you, poster magazines in the UK and I don't know where else, because they didn't copyright it. And he says in an interview, very blatant, he says, he sits like this and he's like, come to Papa Felix to tell you some stories. He says, So I'm like, and there wasn't a damn thing they can do about it. And then he burst out laughing because of the money he made. I'm like, this doesn't fit the narrative, but I love it. So yeah, go on.
No, and again, why I love Felix Dennis is there's also something to be said, and I've seen people do this as well too. Felix obviously had money at that point and was successful, but there's a little bit of a Robin Hood approach to that. Like, he was not, one, they weren't harmed. Like, it's not like they fucked up. He took advantage of an opportunity. It was like, hey, fuck you guys. This is what you're getting. I'm gonna print money doing this over here. It's not like he didn't tank the enterprise. It was a greed conversation. We want beyond the hundreds, back then it was probably hundreds of millions of dollars that we're making. You're skimming single digit millions that we should be getting that we're not getting. So it's almost like a Robin Hood approach. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. It's different from stealing from, you know, there's this, if he was crushing like aspiring entrepreneurs who like built these little businesses and just coming in and destroying them and like affecting their family and ruining their lives. That's a different type of harm compared to like, oh, we screwed over Bank of America. At the end of the day, I think it's the degree of how intensely are you affecting the individual? Because the thing about being an entrepreneur is someone always gets hurt. Right. Like when I started my build.com company, now I don't know how big it is. I think they're like doing over $2 billion. We put a lot of mom and pop showrooms just out of business. Yeah. Like they just couldn't compete. No one wanted to go into the, and I imagine after COVID, it just accelerated that as well too. Yeah. And their unwillingness to change, modify, or move on into a different, I didn't feel bad about it. I mean, it was very public of what was going on, and it was an opportunity. So I crushed it. Now what he was doing is he was arbitraging copyright law. He wasn't doing anything illegal, and he got a kick out of it. I think he would have felt a little bit different if it was like a little bit more nefarious. Like if he was crushing poor children or something along those lines. But it was just kind of him being able to say fuck you to what was a very big and successful organization and arbitraging something that they missed. And I think that was sometimes the spirit of entrepreneurship.
That was exactly the lesson he was sharing, exactly like you said it. He said something along the lines of, this is how you have to do business sometimes, entrepreneurship. Nobody's going to come and say, would you like to make a couple million? Just help yourself. Okay. He said, this was an example he was giving to his statement of, sometimes you have to bulldozer it through, paraphrasing here. But yeah, same conclusion. Now, sometimes you can not copy as in clone a business, but it's that conversation about competition where, and I'm tapping now into your experience as an investor, because you've overseen some company besides building your own, of course. Sometimes you can piggyback on a business that is validated by competition. You can piggyback the competition and say, okay, these guys are crushing it. Obviously, there's space for more. You got to have a new angle, whatever. When's that fine line drawn between? So on one point you mentioned, don't rob. If you rob from the big guys, it's all fine. Who gives a crap about Bank of America? If you rob from the Save the Children Foundation, or I mean, I guess they're big as well. So
yeah, they're pretty big actually.
Yeah, I guess that's fine as well.
Yeah. If you're a small charity or stealing from the Red Cross or stealing funds from the Red Cross to do better charity, then I mean, again, that's creative destruction. It's an interesting, I often jokingly quote, you know, Friedrich Nietzsche, it's talent borrows, genius steals, paraphrased. But I mean, some of the best business models are seeing what somebody else is doing, recognizing the genius of what they're doing, and then doing it better. I mean, MySpace, Facebook, Facebook is a perfect example of going, this MySpace thing is a clusterfuck with a horrible user experience. All they did was make the user experience better and added some incremental functionality and structure and fucking wiped that business off of the map, more or less. And that creative destruction, it creates value for the end user. And it's MySpace wasn't, you know, they weren't taken advantage of. They weren't robbed. They may see it at that. This was our model. But like when somebody creates something new, like a new space, social media was a new thing. And it wasn't created by Facebook. It was created by Friendster or MySpace. Now I'm dating myself. But that creative destruction process is how we move society forward. Of course, I'm not saying that social media is that, patents are kind of a necessary evil in a lot of different businesses for people to be able to, invest and protect their IP. But I hate to bring up Musk again, but he's definitely a big personality in the news. He basically said, hey, anybody that wants to use Tesla's patents, go ahead. I don't give a shit. And I think that a more narrow patent, things like patents can stifle innovation. So it's that creative destruction that really, and it's not, we're talking about taking someone's model and iterating and improving on it. That Instagram example earlier, they just simply had a little bit better UI UX and a little bit better user experience. And that's all it took. And then one day, and now maybe TikTok will be the next thing that they didn't rip off Snapchat. They didn't rip off Instagram. They just simply improved upon what was an existing product. And that's how people continue to innovate. And I'm a huge fan of the talent bars, genius sales. I think the hardest businesses to build are, the Peter Thiel 0 to 1, like building something that doesn't exist mm-hmm. and getting traction. That is the hardest and most difficult thing to do because you've got to, and often long-term, it's somebody else that will come in and take that 0 to 1 business and eventually, disrupt it and improve upon it as that somebody comes in and creates something new. Right. So, I think that's the fairness police want everything to be fair, but life isn't fair. And timing is everything. I think that creative destruction that we're talking about isn't nefarious and it's not negative. And some of the businesses that I look to invest in or angel invest in, if you have no competition, I'm a lot more worried than if there is competition, because then someone is at least validated that your idea is not completely fucking crazy.
Yeah. I want to put two cards on the table for the sake of making this conversation possibly even better. One, the example of, you've mentioned Facebook and MySpace, where they took it and made it better, but sometimes it doesn't even have to become better. Perhaps Microsoft Teams and Slack, the famous example, or Apple Music and Spotify. But then that is big guys with big guys, and people are looking at, you might be hating, but who gives a crap if you're hating? Because they don't seem to hear, or maybe they do, but whatever. But then the second card I want to put on the table is the media perception. So is it even worth taking into account, or do you take it into account, but how do you do it then when you're taking a business that works and saying, I see how I can do this better, and perhaps it's not even evident to the public. Let's say you improve with a distribution strategy, just like, but again, Microsoft is big with Teams. I don't know. I, as you said, something that is not visible to the public distribution. I can't think of anything else. Would you take media or the audience's perception into account? Do you ignore that completely?
I think I'm, and maybe this, I'm showing my age. And I hate to be, I try to stay on the bleeding, but at least the leading edge of what's going on. I'm not a crypto person, but I understand. I try to have a functioning understanding of blockchain and all the different, oracles and the NFT markets. And I don't really participate, but I feel like I need to know, or, the fundamentals of what the leading machine learning tools and everything. So I try to stay on the edge of things technologically, because I hate to become the old timey days guy of, well, back in the old timey days, but when it comes to the current state of media, mm-hmm. It's fucking garbage. Like it's we have the most of society is digesting media either through large networks, which have become the equivalent of Maury Povich. It's all, there's no reporting anymore. It's all spin. It's all partisan. And the sad thing is the reason it's became that way is because that's what gets the clicks. That's what gets people to tune in. It's that fucking rage and dopamine. Mm-hmm. So, and then if it's not that, they're getting their news off of Facebook, which we all know is complete fucking bullshit. And people are believing these things and it's changing their fucking worldview. So I don't give any fucking, the thing that most important to me is, honestly, I like to be in businesses where I don't need a lot of coverage. I'm working on one right now that's one of the most boring businesses in the world. It's in like this commercial B2B thing that mm-hmm. no one's going to give a fuck about unless you're very directly in that space and in that area. Big market, but we'll save that for another podcast.
Yeah.
But I actually, to give you an example, I remember I was even here in Puerto Rico and I was having dinner and I realized quickly that one of the people I was having dinner with was a very, very well-known reporter. And I just shut my fucking mouth. There was nothing good that was going to come out of this conversation.
Yeah.
There was nothing good. And she said, well, Chris, what do you think? Oh, I don't know. There's nothing good that comes out of that. I mean, again, I think your point though, so my take is avoid public media at all costs. Unless, of course, unless you can do it in a very curated, narrow way. Some of the most successful people I know have a persona. I just talked to a very prolific venture capitalist yesterday who's one of the smartest guys that I know. Right. And he is very, very well known as a Midas touch gold. And he's a brilliant guy, smartest people I know, as like a VC. And try to find anything else about him. That's it. Like that is how... if you're going to utilize the media is keep it very, very parallel. Keep it out of your personal life. Keep it from at least an entrepreneur's perspective. And then eventually don't try to take the Elon Musk approach until you're the richest guy in the world, I guess, in regards to how you're going to handle your social media as an entrepreneur or dealing with the media in general. I think that the media has become toxic. I think it's, I cringe with the idea of reporting. And anytime I have ever had to use the media, I did a big fundraiser in Puerto Rico and to distribute generators and we had to use the media. I just was cringing at, because they're looking at how do I spin this into something? How do I create a controversy? You know, if it bleeds, it leads, all that stuff remains true. So if you're dealing with the media, my only advice is just tread very, very lightly because the knife can cut both ways, very sharp.
That is useful. So that's media. I'll ask about this and then move on because I don't want to stick to this for the rest of the podcast. That's media. What about the audience? So the people you're targeting talking amongst themselves could be on the internet, could be in person. What about mm-hmm. their perception of what you're doing, which sometimes might be... what's a word you used earlier? In the gray area, or I used it. So something that could, if I don't have a good example, because I guess if there would be mid-sized company, they wouldn't be too popular. But if Microsoft and Slack were smaller, closer to the average person, let's say they were at, I don't know, 100K MRR. So more people would feel closer, not that far into their kingdom. And one of them did that. People would be saying, oh, look at what they've done. People like us, I would guess, and the people this would understand it's business. But what about the perception of the user? Does my question make sense? I'm not my best with words on this question.
I think I know where you're going, but I think that
is it noise.
The question, especially in today's era, people don't fucking care. Like nobody to even get people's attention is so hard right now that people just don't care. People just don't care. So I think those things, relatively speaking, are non-issues, especially if you keep a relatively low profile. I mean, you really have to go out there and shake trees if you want to start a fight mm-hmm. and make it a public fight with somebody these days. And, Andrew likes to do that occasionally. He tried to pull me into one of his fights. I'm like, dude, I don't want anything to do with this. but I think if you're not a rabble rouser, And it's just normal competition. And, you know, it just happens every day. And nobody gives a shit. You're stealing somebody's, you're poaching somebody's, I won't say stealing, you're poaching somebody's employee. You've knocked off a feature, unless you're at the top of the pyramid, like the Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok war. Just no one cares, man. No one really cares. It might be people, your users and your industry might care, but then it's just a matter, did you do something ethically? And if it was an ethical end round, then they're not going to really care either. So I don't really have any advice, because I don't think it matters.
That's the advice then. It's noise is not signal, and it's useful. It's the answer. Moving on to some other wisdom transfer. By the way, how do you enjoy this? I feel like I'm coming to a Zen master asking for wisdom, these kind of questions.
Listen, I'm a nobody, and I like to stay that way. your questions are very different than I expected. It's very engaging. It's more philosophical than it is tactical, and I appreciate that.
I'm going to come with more philosophy, but maybe a bit tactical. As you get older, it's a very nice segue from your last answer. As you get older, I feel like you're realizing more and more that most of the things that seem that matter did not matter at all.
Oh, did I lose you? Did I lose you for a second?
Yeah, but it's still recording. So I'll see if it's segmented, but okay. it's all good. Anyway, coming back.
Segment's fine. So please.
Go on. I'll let you talk.
So, you know, I'm 40 freaking 5 years old. I'm looking back at my life now. How did this happen? I still feel like I'm freaking your age. Well, I would say there's a couple of things that I think that we're looking back on what I believe then and what I believe now that I still believe now that I would still preach to people is, and it's cliche, but it's true, is especially as young as possible, finding financial independence, keeping your burn rate low and finding financial independence and not being married to a paycheck or a hustle or a side gig or whatever should be every entrepreneur, everybody's goal really is some sense of that getting to the point as quickly as you can, where you don't ever have to worry about working. You don't have to worry about paying rent. You don't have to worry about just where you, and I used to tell, you know, when I go through my conversation with kids at Chico State, when we'd have the, how much money, these all were the entrepreneurial class. So I'm like, you guys want to start a company, how much money do you want to make? And there was a couple of ESG people early on that I want to save the world. Well, okay, save that for the next speaker. But for everybody here that's like, and they'd have these crazy numbers and they'd say, I want to make $100 million. I want to make $500 million. And I'd break that down what that really meant down to their lifestyle. And at the time, this was about 20 years ago, it really came down to 20 to 18 years ago. If you could make $3 to $4 million, this goes back to my conversation with Andrew. And I think Andrew has mentioned this before too. Right. Put that in the bank and you can make, let's just say, you know, maybe back then you could make 5% risk free. And today, of course, you make zero. So there's a lot of risk. There's a lot more risk that you have to take on. And, you know, I forgot what it came out to, but basically you can make $200,000 a year, $180,000 a year, and never have to hit a lick in your life. Could you live off of that as a 19-year-old college student, assuming you didn't get married and have kids and have a mortgage and all these other things that start to weigh on you?
Yeah.
They were like, yeah, actually. So my point to everybody is always I'm not saying don't think big, right? But I'm saying, you know, work on establishing that level of security, because until you get there, then you can never really transition into building your rocket ship company and colonizing Mars or whatever your larger grandiose vision is. So I think that's the one thing that looking back now, my position has not changed on that at all. I think that's very important today for everybody. And you don't have to build something that's going to be the next Google, the next Slack, the next, I don't know, whatever is hot right now. However, if I was look back and say, what are the things that I thought? And after I made some money, I thought, well, now that I've made some money, I've got to make a shit ton more money. Like now I've got this base and now I can 10X and 20X this. And And one, I didn't, and I worked for a while at it, and I wasn't. I started to realize all my weaknesses, and just because I had one hit didn't mean that I was good at everything. I had some bitter failures, and you could call this sour grapes, but at the same time now, things are going very well for me, and I have plenty of money, and I have plenty of security, and I have some great things happening. But I think what I did realize is, like, once you kind of reach a point and a threshold, continuing to focus on money becomes maniacal. And there is definitely a point where you, and some people I know have done a much better job of this, is where you really work on yourself right. as a human being, you know, really having a good balance between work life. And I don't ever think I'll stop investing or working on companies or doing things because I enjoy it. But, like, really taking a step back and working on your interpersonal relationships, what you enjoy, time for yourself. And if I want to give anything up to the millennial generation, I think they've done a much better, less on the latter and a better job on the former in regards to chasing experiences and travel and putting an emphasis on that I wish I would have done earlier in my life, I think. So going back to our balance, right? So those are the two things that I think, this is a little contradictory, but I'll say, money is really important. It's really important to make money until it's not important. Right. And then don't get caught on that wheel and that focus, as that becomes your identity and who you are. And even if you're really good at it, though, you become a billionaire, then you make 2 billion, then you make 5 billion. What the fuck are you going to do with the money? The money starts to own you. Now you own houses, and now you've got house managers all over the world, and you've got multiple jets, and you've got a team that manages these things, and the team has to check in with you and go, hey, the jet in Milan unfortunately has engine maintenance, so I know we were hoping to do this, but we just want to clear that it's okay, that we're gonna have a charter plane for you and your family. At that point, I don't know, maybe that's what some people desire, but for me, it's definitely that balance between making enough money where you never have to worry about it again, and then making sure that you spend enough time focusing on yourself, your interpersonal relationships. I guess that's
more money, more problems. That's interesting.
Biggie Smalls.
Yeah, there you go.
A lot you can get from the one-liners of some of the classics, that's for sure.
Yeah, and sadly left us too early. We might have had more one-liners, or maybe who knows. Would your answer change? So you've given this piece of wisdom in how it relates to life. Would your answer change in any way, or would it stay the same if I would ask you the same question, but so you get better at spotting, with time you get better at spotting what matters and what doesn't in business? So let's say launch day, to a lot of people, launch day look like it's a make it or break it. But the seasoned entrepreneurs I've talked to said, unless you're like, I guess Apple was, but those were different times and you had the big keynote, it doesn't really matter. Or maybe losing a client that is overly critical in emails and you take, you know, it becomes more serious. The seasoned people, I guess this is what seasoned means. It means you've been through the seasons. The seasoned people I've talked to keep telling me that, look, many things look like they matter, but they don't when you get older. Would your answer change if we talk about business day to day? And then number two question, follow up to what you just said, how would you advise younger people to spot, to tell between what matters and what doesn't? I mean, is there any way? Because maybe the only answer is just live it and find out for yourself. Maybe this is a shortcut not worth taking.
Yeah, I mean, I still often run into people, younger people. Fuck, how did I get old? I swear I was your age like yesterday. that are really have really nailed it, man. Like, have really figured out life, work balance, life. They have their goals. They know what their goals are. They're achieving their goals, and they're kind of living their authentic lives. And I look at them and I'm like, fuck, you're really nailing it. I think I can do that because of hindsight. Mm-hmm. I think we're all going to kind of have our own path in regards to that, you know, part of the journey is the struggle. I think there's like a, I think a saying, there's like a the five, there's some nurse put it out there, allegedly, who knows if it was really, it's the internet, you can't believe anything. It was like the things that people that are dying say the most, like, right. I wish I would have really lived an authentic life and done the things that I wanted to do. You can go out and quote it because I'm going to fuck the whole thing up. You know, I wish I would have spent more time with my family. I think those, like all of those are just fundamental truths. It's like living authentically, doing the shit that you want to do, despite what society says or your friends say, or the shame that you receive from your parents or anybody else. Spending time with your family, assuming you like your family, or your family you choose, which may not be your genetic family.
Yeah.
Traveling and seeing the world and experiencing other cultures and other people. You can look at another good 10 to look at is the Burning Man principle. The 10 principles of Burning Man. those are good commandments to live by as well too. So yeah, I think I look back on, and the other thing is like really look back as you're getting older, look back and ask yourself, you know, the things you're going to regret the most are the things that you didn't do as opposed to the things that you do. So lean in and fuck it, go for it. Like whatever it may be, because you're going to look back and regret things more that you didn't do out of fear, out of how people would think about you, how you'd look, as opposed to just fucking going for it. On your deathbed, you will much more regret the things you did or you didn't do as opposed to things that you do. That's the philosophy I live by. I was on a plane about a year and a half back, and like engine failure. They're having a problem with one of the engines, and we're flying over the ocean, and I'm like, and the fucking, when the flight attendants have that look of like, they're fucking panicking and running around, you're like, fuck, this might be it. Like, this might be it. And first I was scared, the whole cabin's terrified. And then I'm like, you know, I really just took inventory of my life. And I'm like, wrote a little note on my phone to send, hopefully it would get back to my family. And I was like, I'm ready. Like, if this is it, this is it. And if you're not living your life in a way where you can be comfortable in that moment, there's probably something wrong with the way that you're living your life.
I'll meditate on that, because you have no clue of knowing this, but I have a list of things I might be overlooking, where I put down stuff that the back of your head says you have to do this, but you consciously or unconsciously say no to. And I even meditated on why did I do that. I think it's just because I don't want to be able to tell myself I told you so, or maybe to be able to do that. The thing I hate the most is having something coming from the blind side and slapping me. And no matter how much you try, it's still going to happen, I would say. But at least this is an effort to pick at it by having that list. And there's no way for you to know this, but one of the mistakes I might be doing is exactly what you've just advised me now. So maybe that's, who knows, a sign. Maybe you've just changed my life with this piece of advice for the better.
The advice, you know, take the advice for as much as you paid for it. So I mean, take credence with how much you paid for it. But I mean, maybe that slap on the head is not telling you to think about it, but... you know, Felix Danvers. Oh no, that was who's? I forget. No, that was Branson. Yeah, screw it, just do it.
Yeah, like, screw it, let's do
go
it.
Go for it, man. Yeah, most of the things that I regret were the things that I didn't do. Right. Most of the things in my life I regret, and the beautiful thing is you can wake up tomorrow and just start fucking doing them, whatever that is, whatever that means in business and your personal life and your, you know, I had a big change for me, which I was fortunate, right after I sold my company, I, 6 months out, I was driving out of the office and I had to like cut across this intersection because I forgot something. It's like a hard drive cable or shit back when we used to work on our own computers. And I got T-boned at about 65 miles per hour. I still think that the scars are, yeah, there's still some scarring there.
Slightly, yeah.
And I don't remember the impact. The next thing I remember, I'm behind the car. And there's like exhaust. I'm looking at the car's exhaust and I see blood everywhere. And I'm like, what the fuck? And then like EMTs are like, sir, quit walking around, sir. And then like, somebody like, sits me down and ambulances and shit. And I'm just like, blood's just everywhere. And I'm like, I don't even know what happened. And they're like, they sit me down. They're like, hey, so what's your name? And I go to, I can't speak. And they're like, do you know? And then they're that, like, I start to be able to talk again. They're like, do you know what year it is? And I'm like, confused. They're like, ER right now. In the back of the ER, they got this like turban thing on my head. And they said to me, I said, am I going to die? And they said, the bless his heart. It's like, I don't know. It's like, fuck. Like, I worked so hard. I put all this, my entire 10 years of my life in this company to make all this money, and now I'm going to fucking die. I get to the ER and I'm a loopy. And like, they're like, okay, Mr. Friedland, and they're all just the neurosurgeons here. If we there may be pressure on your brain. We're going to fly you to Stanford. We're going to do a CT. And depending on what comes back, we're going to fly you to Stanford. And I'm just sitting there like, what the fuck? I get my CT. They're like, oh, no, just you got a concussion. We're going to stitch you and send you home. But Jesus. It was a pivotal point in my life.
Yeah.
And I said, fuck, I could die any single day. Any day I could fucking die. And it completely changed my life. And that's where I, like, maybe this conversation helped you change yours, was I said, fuck it. I'm going to Burning Man. My wife's like, what the fuck? Going where? I'm like, you coming with me or not? I'm fucking doing it. I'm doing fucking everything I want to fucking do. And that accident really changed my entire position in life. I was 32 years old. I'm grateful for it. I'm grateful for the impact that it had. I'm grateful for the fact that it opened my eyes to what was important, which is experiences, relationships, interpersonal growth. And I listen, it's not been a straight line path for me, trust me. But like, I think that recognition was a door opening for me to help me become more of a person that can be on that plane that's about to crash in the ocean and be zen.
Mm-hmm. Do you, I swear, I didn't expect this conversation to go into this direction, but I'm loving it. I promise no ghost stories. I won't ask you for that. But like on a more spiritual note, if you feel like sharing that, do you ever feel like, maybe because this example made me think of that, do you ever feel like signs from the universe or God or karma, whatever word you might prefer to use for that entity? Or was that possibly a sign? Would you take it as that, or you just not think about it in this way?
You know, the Hubble telescope, and you've got to watch, it's like there's a little series on the Hubble about the vastness that we've discovered, the vastness of the universe and the number of universes and galaxies and like the scale of that, our little monkey brains just can't even wrap our heads around that. There's a fucking galaxy for every grain of sand on this planet. Try to rationalize that in your monkey brain. Like, try to realize that that's the reality. Like, all the shit you see on Star, light speed, like, at fucking light speed, we couldn't even get, you know, to near the end of the galaxy. I mean, it's so inconceivable, the size and expansion of the universe that we live on this teeny little fucking speck of dust. We don't know anything. We don't know fucking anything, man. Like, no fucking clue. So sometimes I feel that way. I do feel like there are forces and energies and things that are happening around us that we are completely fucking clueless to, that 100 years from now we'll be like, can you believe back in 2020 they had no idea of of this? Like, things like, I think we'll realize more things like about what empathy really means and different senses that we may have that we haven't even discovered yet, because we just don't have the tools or even the mental capability to understand them, and eventually those will come. So when it comes to those things, I like to think so, but I don't put a lot of, my wife often says she's God's chosen child because she's incredibly lucky. Like, it's almost silly how lucky that she ends up being. So yeah, maybe luck is a real thing. Maybe we're born with, maybe we have luck. And what is, why are other, some people luckier than others? I don't fucking know. I mean, the Chinese are big believers in luck and numbers and those types of things. Maybe there's something there.
Yeah.
What I've learned is I'm not a scientific positivist. And I think there's a lot of people out there that I can't relate to that are.
What does
if
that mean?
I can't definitively prove it with science, it doesn't exist or is not a possibility. Mm. I hate people like that, because every year, every couple of years, a whole universe of possibilities presents itself that were completely impossible the year before.
Yeah.
So I'm a believer in the impossible, and I because of that, it's hard for me to truly believe in anything, which is ironic.
I've noted down the Hubble telescope, and I've also noted down the Burning Man principles and Screw It, Let's Do It on my to-do list. I'll look into them after. On the flip side, I've sent you just now an email with a video, 3 minutes about a galaxy. You don't need any kind of shrooms or weed or whatever. That thing puts you, if you watch it with your lights closed on a screen, even on a laptop, it came to my mind. I haven't watched it in 5 years, I think. It came to my mind as you were saying that. So anytime you have time, spend those 3 minutes. From NASA, so you can expect it might have even be shot on the Hubble. Not sure.
Probably is.
But
Probably is.
Give it a go one day, because it's highly related to what you just said. Well, that's where you are on this range. That's where you're calibrated with, I don't fucking know, but at the same time, it feels like it. But then I get back to, I don't fucking know. And your answer is as good as mine or anybody else's. Leaving philosophy and spirituality behind, or I guess we'll come back to it, because it all converges to that point. You've said on Andrew's podcast that Silicon Valley people only talk about money behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. Is there more to it, or is it just what you already touched upon, which is with Musk and Gates and Zuckerberg? Is it more? Is it just what you touched already upon with, it all has to start at that level with money? Or
I think it's different. And let me be clear. I've been Puerto Rican now for 6 years, and we have much different values and priorities here, you know, chinchorreros and beach days. So there's definitely not as much of a edgy environment like the Valley. There's things, and again, I was never a big Silicon Valley person. Mm. I grew up in Chico. My company was in Chico. You know, my life was basically spent in Chico, which is, you know, 3 hours from the Valley. So my time down there, I have contacts there and friends, and I've helped raise money for things and so forth, but I'm not a Valley person. From my perspective, it's old, but back then it was definitely, that money was only talked about behind closed doors. It was not always about mission. It was inauthentic is what I felt it was. It was about mission, vision, this and this. And it wasn't about how are we going to make a shit ton of money. That may have changed. I don't know if the authentic, and again, it's not always just about money, right? It's about creating value. There's definitely the majority of the conversation is we're going to build something. It's going to create a bunch of value. People are going to love it. It's going to disrupt something. It's going to be great. And we're going to make a fuck ton of money doing it. And here's why. And I think there's a definite allergy to that. And honestly, because I feel that the political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, have become more polarized than ever, and the media has exacerbated this polarization, that my guess would be it's probably gotten worse in the Valley about the money behind closed doors conversation, because it's so out of touch with the message of the politics of that community, generally speaking. But I don't really know anymore, because I'm just so far removed, but that would be my guesstimate, but it was definitely my impression before that. And I think if people had more honest, I think people don't have honest conversations about money fucking anywhere. You don't have them in your household with your kids. You don't teach them in school really about money and creating value and how to build wealth. And then even in the Valley, we're going to raise money, we're going to do this thing. And then the conversation about the money and the economics, and it shouldn't dominate it, because you're building a company and you're creating value and everything, but it's just like, it is taboo. It's weird how we look at money as a society. And now the way we look at money entirely is blowing up because all this cryptocurrency madness that's going on. That's a whole nother fucking conversation.
For another podcast. Getting closer there to a subject that's closer to you and your school of thought in business. I want to ask you about something you might be able to share from your experience. As people get richer, I might be wrong, let me know if you disagree. As people get richer, or at least they've ticked that first level of the staircase, they're more likely to partner with other people on a deal. Why is that? Is it just less risk, time limits, more smartness pulled together, lack of time to devote?
I have definitely learned. So I was always a little bit of, and I still remain, although I've been singed quite a bit on it, is I've always enjoyed betting on the underdog, because I was the underdog, right? Like, everybody thought I was an idiot. I was told I needed to go raise money in the Valley for my first company. Everybody laughed me out of the Valley with Fawcett Direct. Who the fuck's going to buy Fawcett on the internet? You're an idiot. So I've always kind of been, I've kind of thumbed my nose at the institutional capital establishment. Fuck you, I'm doing my own way. And I've enjoyed funding people's companies who would never fit into that mold. Like, no one is going to fund you, but I will, because like Andrew Gazdecki, your grit, determination. And now he's got great tier A investors, way better than me. So good for him. What I have learned by being on the other side of it, investing in private equity funds and venture type funds, is the power of smart connected capital is a rich kids club. Like, once you break into that world, and the reason why these people, why people with who are smart and with money pool together, it's one, if somebody I know really smart, it's almost like the equivalent of Instagram model promotion, right? Well, if Kylie Jenner says it's good, then it must be good on a micro idiot level. But on a macro smart rich person level, if, you know, Doug Leone at Sequoia Capital has blessed this thing, he's obviously vetted it. He's very, very smart. They've looked at the metrics. Then, of course, I don't want to, I don't have to even have to do any work. I can just piggyback into Doug's success record and track, and we're good. So these people end up with these networks and they pool together and they work together. And then you've got the power of not just their money, but their networks as well, that perpetuate you, that almost like create a, they king you to some degree in certain industries. If you raise money from X, it says a lot about who you are because of how smart the people that are associated with. And if you can piggyback into raising money with X and Y and Z, it builds out this fort of, you have all this capital, all this access to talent, all this access to some of the biggest brains, and wealth perpetuates wealth perpetuates wealth. I don't know how I feel about it. I just think it kind of is what it is. You know, birds of a feather flock together. So what does it mean? Get in the club. That's what it means. Get in the club.
If you want to play that game.
You don't need to live in that world as well too. I like to dabble in that world, but I don't live there. I have a couple great connected friends, and you know, there's my one of my good friends turned out to be one of the best hedge funds I ever invested in, is my friend Mitchell Green from Lead Edge Capital. And he's a very authentic, funny, direct, he's fucking crazy, but so am I. So that's probably why we're late. But Mitchell, Mitchell's been, I put money into his first fund that I thought was a fucking horrible idea. I'm like, this is in it like 7x. And he's like, just put the money, put the rest of it in my next fund. My first fund's coming alive. I'm like, oh fuck. All right, Mitchell, sure. We're on fund 10, 11 now. Nice. I just talked to him and he called me like, okay, so fund's opening. Here's what you're putting in it. I'm like, you know what, Mitchell, fuck you. You know, I'm your good luck charm, and I'm small investor. He's got like $3 billion under management. And I'll say, you know what, the worst thing I could do is put nothing in, and I'm your fucking good luck charm. He's like, fuck, you're right. Okay, what do you want to do? and he's the epitome of smart connected capital. He's the guy, if I all of a sudden need to get a meeting with the president or a call with the president, I don't know how the fuck I'm going to do this, but I have to talk to Joe Biden or Donald Trump or whoever the fuck the president is of the day. Mitchell will probably be the first guy to call. He'll be like, hold on, I know a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy.
What's he doing?
So there's a benefit to those networks.
What's he doing that gets him connected, smart capital connected? What would you see from outside?
Well, one, you got to be smart. Like, that's kind of a qualifier to get in the club. You can't be an idiot. I'm probably on the lower end of I'm, you know, if these are all the smart guys, I'm probably at the bottom end of the smart guy ladder.
I would disagree. We're gone.
And he is the most tenacious motherfucker I've ever met in my life. Like, he used to work at Bessemer, which was with Jeremy Levine, who's a great, one of the smartest VCs I know. And he was his squire, I call him. He doesn't like when I say that. But he would literally just fucking dial 100 companies a day, you know, trying to get in touch with the CEO, get the metrics behind it, and create lead gen for the firm. Mm-hmm. And that's how we met. He cold called me when I was at Proven Direct, then Bill.com. And that tenacity, even though he has built a significant amount of wealth for himself, has not stopped. The guy is fucking relentless. And he's also a guy, you know, he doesn't have a big social media profile. He's not out there on Twitter. He's very, very successful. And he is very well known where he wants to be known, not you know, out there trying to build an audience of idiots.
So that's a fine line to tread on. But yeah, I'll be looking into it. You have a lot of great stuff to share, but I want to ask you, how do apprentices win your heart? But before that, I want to actually ask you, can apprentices win your heart so that you feel like helping them? This is all based on my assumption that I've seen with some people who achieve at least a modicum level of success. They just love sharing that with the next generation to pass the baton, at least in my experience, simply because that's what happened to them as well. Can that happen even if you're not investing in somebody? So if you're investing, let's take Andrew, your angel investment in Andrew. Over there, you're both on the same page. I know it wasn't your investment of a lifetime and you just liked somebody who had the hunger and the grit. Perhaps it's not the best example, but let's say that's not a bulletproof example. Are people able to get advice from somebody they look up to even though an investment would not take place? Is that exclusive usually?
Here's the funny thing is I tend to be overly generous with my time. I've learned to be less because I'm probably on the extreme side of that. But one thing Andrew Gazdecki taught me, I mean, the age old adages that I heard from my prior generation are still fucking true. It's always no until you ask. Actually, my father-in-law is the one that taught me that. Frank Hill, that sells insurance, great guy. Frank's got a book. There's an ass for every saddle. He's got a bunch of great ones, but it's always no until you ask. And surprisingly, you reach out. I mean, again, look at, you know, some people on Twitter, like if you ask a good question and you're direct and it's relevant, people will answer you. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are more generous with their time. You just got to give it a shot. You got to make the pitch. You got to ask and be relevant. Like, don't, hey, I really need the worst I fucking hate. Hey, I really need to set up a call for you. There's something I'd like to talk to you about. Fuck you. Yeah, I want to spend a half hour of my time some jack off. Here's what I'm doing. Here's what's going on. I have this thing. This is what I'm going. I have a question about this. Can you help? Yeah, actually, fuck. I'm exactly the right guy you want to talk to. Sure, call me. And I don't think that I'm exclusive in that. I think you can talk to pretty much anybody, any of the luminaries or whatever. Just be relevant. Mm-hmm. And just make sure that you're not wasting their time. If I had a breakthrough for interspecies or warp drive that I was fucking dead set on was it, I'm sure not somebody at NASA would return my call. I'm sure Elon Musk would take a 30-minute call with me to walk through my theory on warp drive. But it's relevant, right? It's just be relevant to the person. Hey, Elon, I want to talk to you about my startup. Shut the fuck up. Like, yeah. I don't care about your startup. Or Bill Gates, I want to talk to you about this operating system I'm building. Well, it better be fucking something like an Android killer. He may take the call. I mean, that's probably shooting too far. I think you might want to talk to
the example.
Linus Torvalds or somebody. But
yeah, and I've seen this before. And I mean, I get as well, hey, can we jump on a call? And I'm not even that protective with the time, but I see why it doesn't attract me. There's nothing to buy because you're not selling. Do you have to go in 17 minutes?
I technically have to go as soon as possible, but I'm over in my next call. But...
Crap. Okay. Should we feed one last question or should we end this? Because I want to hold you for 3 minutes if that is okay with you after I stop the recording.
Let's ask one more and then we'll hang on for the next three.
I want to end up on a softball. I don't play baseball. I'm not American. Is softball like a good question for you? Something that is in your favor?
Yeah, softball is a simple one. Hardball would be not a curve. Right between the eyes.
Yeah. I just want to ask you what comes to mind if I ask you what are the fine things you enjoy in life? Doesn't have to be material, but I see you've got one of the nicest backgrounds I've had with my interview so far. You've got a Hag Capisco, the chair you're sitting on, which is super nice.
You know the Hag Capiscos? I love this chair.
Lovely.
It's great. One of my favorites. Sometimes if I get, turn around in it.
That's the point.
What is it, Danish design?
I think so. Nordic for sure. Could be. Because I know the A in Hag has a circle, like one of the special characters that the Nordic people, Northern European people use. But a lovely chair. And I love chairs. I spend probably sometimes too much time looking at them or researching them. And I know this one. And then it got much more popular because Joe Rogan started using it. But I think you've had it from... Yeah.
The Hag Capisco? Does he?
Yeah. In one of his new studios after he struck the deal with Spotify. Because now he changed it again. But this was one he had.
I've had this thing for 10 years. Yeah. I've had this thing for 10 years.
It's
lovely. I have another house in... it's an Airbnb rental now. I used to live there, but I have one there too. I have one wherever I pull up a desk.
So it's your must have.
That's the price of it.
Yeah.
So
what other fine things do you enjoy in life? Because a Hag Capisco is a nice thing to have. So I can vouch for that as well, even though I'm not sitting on one. anything else that comes to mind? Are you like a car guy? Do you like cigarettes, cigars, I guess?
No, I am big on, I'm not big on stuff at all. So, I have my $129 Why Things watch with things. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. I've been a customer for like 10 years. I love these things. They do the basics that I need. And it's like a 22 hour charge. Point being is like, I don't have a Rolex. I don't have a Ferrari. My son's always asking, Dad, why don't you get a Ferrari? What the fuck am I going to do a Ferrari? For one thing, I'm in Puerto Rico. It's like the pothole center of the world. I do have a very, very nice house, but I think it's even too big now that I've got two kids moving out of the house here in Puerto Rico. And I think it's important to have a nice house that you feel, that's warm and comforting and your nest, right? But I'm not a stuff guy. I'm definitely more of an experiences person. I love to travel. I love to meet new cultures. I love to meet new people. I mean, the one thing that me and my wife really enjoy traveling is because we're both, especially after a couple glasses of wine, we'll just start hanging out with strangers. We'll show up at dinner. Next thing you know, we'll be out with a group of eight strangers at a nightclub and just like, and we make friends very, very easily and build relationships. That's probably one of the things that I enjoy the most. I'm not a stuff guy, I'm an experiences guy. And I learned a lot of that after my accident of going off to some of these experiential festivals or traveling to places that people, I think one of the biggest, and so I don't have five things, but I would say that is the big one. And if there's a point that I'd like to make with people, and this is what's really, really been a fucking disaster, which the media has continued to exacerbate, has been the fear that people have created around people and travel. And I had COVID twice. We could have a whole nother conversation about COVID. I had COVID, I got vaccinated, I got COVID again, and it sucks and it's sick and it's sad when people die about it, but it's became a political thing. And I think the scariest thing about it is it's created fear for people to go out. It's stuffed people back in their homes. And I think that that's just fucking criminal. I think that, and even the media as well, creates fear around travel. Well, I'm not going to Tulum, Mexico because there was a shooting there at a club. Yeah, there was a shooting there at a club. And the other 364 days a year, other than some minor pickpocket, nothing ever fucking happened. You live in San Juan, Puerto Rico, that's the murder capital of the world. Well, guess what? Don't sell cocaine and don't fuck some Puerto Rican guy's wife. And that's about 99% of the murders that happen here in Puerto Rico. So people don't do risk analysis and they get scared and they never leave their little bubble. And I think that that's one of the biggest mistakes that people make in regards to what's, at least I value, something that's very important, which is travel, new experiences, meeting new people, and adventure.
So that's your answer then. Those are the fine things you enjoy in life. That's one answer is better than a list of five, as you said. So I'll take that. Christian, should we direct people to follow you anywhere? Should we just invite them to take a hike, steal your best advice, and email you in 10, 20 years saying, I learned this from you. I made it. Thanks to you. Thank you.
That would be the sweetest ever. You can follow my very boring Instagram. I'm not very active on Twitter. I have one follower on TikTok, and I only go there to watch my kit. Oh, I experiment a little bit as well too. But no, I don't, find another hero. But if I offered you any advice, when you're wildly rich and famous, email me and thank me. And you know, if you want to invite me on a yacht trip or a private jet trip somewhere exotic, I would be more than happy to take that as consideration.
Okay, then anybody listening to this, myself included, that is able to invite Chris on a yacht or on a PJ trip is now obliged to do it. So expect an email with the next 20 years, I hope.
When Gazdecki makes his first $1 billion on his selling Micro Acquire, he can pick me up in Puerto Rico and we can head over to Ibiza or something for a week.
There we go. Andrew, you've been paged. You've been officially paged. Christian Friedland, thank you so much. It's been an honor.
Thank you, Daniel.